Just so you know, her books are also on sale, and they're 11 euro, and they're right behind us.
That's red, I think you're on. As Ciarán said there, I'm reading from a collection tonight called Revenant, and the collection is dedicated to my cousin's niece who died 5 years ago after a long and very difficult illness. Her name was Anna, but we called her Goose. So this is Goose, in memory of Anna McAllister. Walking evenings stretched out into a prairie of stars. It seemed crimson and gold would not rise through bark and bole, and the goose following celestial cues and the music of the spheres would never leave the soft bed you spun for her, compassed by a newly hatched sun. Falling like the bitterest snow, the molt had been hard, leaving her weak till tail feathers started to bud on a harvest moon's pink edge. Its strange light, striking lodestones behind dull eyes, sparked the fires of flight ancient watchers of northern southern skies had described. Navigating night's amethrine heart, she left without a word, each wing flap creating uplift for those trailing after on a journey to the land of musk ox, white bear, arctic hare and fox. Drawn along Earth's magnetic course, she separates milk from water, feeding on pearls deep in the silvery reeds, back once more in her true north. Anna was one of those revenants that you want to keep close, you want to keep her near. There are, of course, revenants that you can't do that with. You have to keep them at arm's length, no matter how difficult and how painful that is. Because if you don't, you'll end up drained dry. This poem is called The Hungry Goose, Ghost. I was wondering about Van Helsing. The ferrous humour just aren't cutting it. She has returned, crawled out of the hills, her translucent skin scorched in a white summer moon. I have reminded her of her death, explained the causes, spoke of obsequies carried out to the letter, wrote in black ink, "You have gone forth," all the time her green gleaming eye glancing my throat. I have seen her bones in hard frost, heard the ceaseless howl of her swollen silvery stomach, on bad nights left offerings of milk and marigolds at the edge of a spinney of mountain pine. I used to think her kind could be stilled with incantation and flowers, palm oil and bowls of bright feathers, but the souterrains of her jealousy and greed require the warm lapping of an open vein. At times I was able to spare a pint or two, even juke with red berry mojitas and Bloody Marys. Now, with her guile growing and my hemoglobin at an all-time low, I need her gone for good from this rickety door. Then perhaps I could grieve, listen to Mozart's Requiem, Patsy Cline, or Time Out of Mind, even dislodge this bolus of large and little lies, the threats of self-harm, spangling my craw like a scramble of stars. It is time for the Heimlich manoeuvre. Van the main man, the very man for the job. Once my breathing is freed up, he will encircle me with Eucharist and words in Latin and oil heated and fires rendering injured icons. Glad when her footsteps fade from these streets, I will leave no alms at the town gates, no orris root, no food, no wine, and ask no diviner if hard snows will come to the high stony ground. Thank you very much. On the 8th of April 2013, Margaret Thatcher died in the Ritz Hotel in London. And I just thought this was fascinating. The same day, the other side of the world, Pablo Neruda was being exhumed. His bones were being brought up into the light the day that Thatcher was sinking down into the dark. Neruda, there had always been suspicions about his death. There were people thought that he had been killed by Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet's regime, and he was being exhumed. His bones were being brought up for forensic tests, which actually did suggest, they showed that he hadn't died of cancer. The findings were inconclusive, but they did tend to point towards foul play, state involvement in his death. Pinochet had executed and disappeared over 2,200 people, and he was never brought to justice. And Margaret Thatcher played a very key role in enabling him, who they were friends, and she was a staunch supporter, to evade justice. So I thought it was kind of weird that the day Pablo was coming up, Margaret was heading down. Neruda's exhumation. Margaret Thatcher's eyes, closing today in the Ritz Hotel, seemed to open his in the dry, salty air of Chile's volcanic coast. His shining bones, washed anew in a ravenous, blistering blue, rise up again to the welcoming strains of a dusty suited string quartet, playing within earshot of all ship's mermaids, suspended like ghosts mid-flight round the house he dry-docked on that rocky outcrop. Home to collections of seashells, strange-shaped bottles, bowls of bright green words used to staunch the blood flowing from a wound in the desert's starry side. Its long silvery scar snaking through planets and paper lanterns, flickering with his passage from crashing Pacific to government lab, reading bones anew before second burial. Day of the first, crowds thronged the streets, sorrow streaming down black and white photos. But how long do people weep? 1,000 days or one? Hiding gypsy prayers in a cello's flaming mane, some weep still, weeping till emerald ink leaves a pure white page. This next poem is also about an exhumation. Elizabeth Siddal, as you probably know, was an English poet and artist in the 19th century, but unfortunately she was better known in her own time and in ours as a model. She was painted extensively by her husband, Gabriel Dante Rossetti, and she probably was the first supermodel. And when she died, her grief-stricken Rossetti had his poems buried along with her. And then 6 years later, he thought, Jesus, I could really use those poems. He was kind of pressurized as well, although it maybe didn't need an awful lot of pressure, by an unscrupulous art dealer called Howell to apply for a license, to apply for permission to have Elizabeth exhumed from her wee plot 5770 in Highgate Cemetery. The whole affair was very sad. In life, she was kind of renowned for her great head of hair, a woman with a queer head of hair, and the same thing happened after she died. Howell began to myth make about her hair still growing after her death. So unfortunately, that head of hair came to kind of define her again. The exhumation of Elizabeth Siddal. It was 5 minutes before midnight when the knock came to my Highgate door. Howell, washed in white moonlight, took a good gulp, then snatched the poems. startling to be sure, yet scarcely a surprise. I always knew you'd want them back, and truth told, I wasn't sorry to see them go. The calfskin cover had chafed my ear for the best part of 7 years, and between ourselves, I hadn't read a single line. The light in here being bleeding mofo. But don't get me wrong, he meant well enough. I even half hoped he might appear, lured by the prospect of a face wan with waiting. Supreme Beata Beatrix sequel painted plein air. The apotheosis of a pre-Raphaelite woman, languorous bones, long and lovely on teal silk, and a coffin full of red gold hair. Thank you. I'm going to kind of stay on the subject of exhumations here. The Catholic Church were also a dab hand at them. Many a saint's bones were hauled up to the surface and body parts taken as relics. Saint Teresa of Avila was no exception. Her fabulous heart is in a reliquary, very ornate one, in her own country. Teresa was a 16th century Spanish mystic who wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote beautifully, and also wrote under the eye of the Spanish Inquisition, which was extremely difficult. She was a major figure in Counter-Reformation Europe, a thorn in Luther's side and a thorn in the Vatican side, a thorn in any bloody side she could be a thorn in. She was kind of a paradoxical figure. When she was experiencing her religious ecstasies, she frequently levitated, she rose up, but she was also very rooted, somebody who was very off the earth. Just many things to many people. This is called St. Teresa's Heart. Claiming it a charism, too diamond for the dark, they hung her heart out to dry in a glass globe. Scored and scraped with a life story, the walls of its chambers reverberate still. A girl calling out to another inscribes amber swallows and nival lilies on woodwork no one can unravel. A mystic with inquisitorial breath brimming the nape of her neck etches on stone, he has no body but my own, immaculate and shining in fields of barley this flesh has flown. A nun crossing night's cedar soul writes on an acre of snow, O my sisters, this eye left, leaving only entrails filled with stars and garnets. An old woman contemplating a wide geranium sky, pencils in its margins. Morning has come, all is light and all are inexorably pierced, peregrine and moon circling, Earth's fine tilth. This poem is about Joan of Arc, who was burned at the stake in 1431. As you know, she heard voices and she wasn't tortured by them the way some people are. She loved her voices. It's also been suggested that perhaps if Joan was about today, she would be a trans person, and that is probably accurate. I suppose in the poem I was trying to imagine those last moments of her life and wondering what she saw, if it's possible to see anything when you're in such agony. But if it is, then I hope it was the sky. St. Joan's Myrrh. Pouring over her like amethyst and water, the voices tell how she glowed white and gold, walking with knight's bed and doublet and hose, whispering, we know, breast buds bruise, plaits hiss, myrrhs sicken, they slip away in snow drifting petals, leaving her luminous in the garden of almonds. She will put the Dauphin on the throne, raise the fleur-de-lis over Orléans, and in male attire still be, their astral child, and viable, and the last pond of sky. This poem is about a neighbour of mine. She's now dead, a neighbour from Drumagarner, where I live. But you'll remember. Julia was somebody who she simply had no interest whatsoever in stuff. She just was not interested in material possessions at all. She probably left zero carbon footprint, if that's possible. The love of her life was her grandson, who had what would have been classified then as profound learning disabilities. They were very severe. And I think Julia realised that learning disabilities don't mean the absence of thought, even great thought, wonderful thought, but simply our inability to access it. Something back in memory of Julia Magatier. Today your daughter said everyone wants something back. The site she sold for an old house tilted like a womb are now gone back field, that oblong of pristine green. The root of a lushing lilac bush, earth for 100 years, a white scarred gelding, traded how many snows before you died, gaining in granite a syllable you never had in life. An absence filled with ibis and orioles and waxwings, your name in that girl's ear, a rare, fleeting, foreign thing, you would never have claimed your own. You never did, the two bedrooms sleeping five, the living room clean of ornament and antimacassar, the two postage stamps of grass separated by a short path, host to a boy hatching joy from a gnarled brush shaft, the books you read but did not own or want to own, circulating like wandering stars through silver poplars. Their light barred always from your grandson's satchel, empty of paper and pencil, those tools of an intellect I doubt you would have wanted back, knowing his dawn's break in water clear and deep and wide, no man with line and plumb will ever come. Kieran said there earlier that I had trained as a psychiatric nurse. I also worked quite a bit back then with people with learning difficulties. And this poem is really about one home in particular. Again, most of the people in it would have been classified then as having profound learning difficulties. And there was a tendency among relatives and staff to use the phrase, his voice, her voice. I'm his voice, I'm her voice, I'm their voice. And I really can't think of anything more reductive that you could say about another person. I mean, it was well-intentioned, but really, you can be somebody's spokesperson or their representative, but you cannot be their voice. They all, every one of them, have voices. We just couldn't decipher them. But voices is what they had. Giving voice to. Beneath the window, blue morning glory and spit spill from a girl's lips. On the floor, a boy shakes his head from side to side and groaning glitters plants with the scent messages of wolves. Over in the corner, a young woman gently slip sliding along the crest of an incontinence pad, throws back her head, sound irised and molten pouring from her mouth. In this place where the non-verbal dwell, speech is many, spiral, shrapnel, ovoid, rose, mine, an Arabian cat, hardest to catch if any, all claws and velvet it melts into gold peninsular light, its small howl reminding mother, father, helper, you are not my voice. Um, I was watching a clip on YouTube of a couple of years ago of Amy Winehouse, and I felt like a member of the press or a voyeur. It was very evidently near the end of her life, and she just looked so ill and emaciated and unwell. And I thought, why in the name of Christ did anybody post that on YouTube? And then she started to sing, and I realised why. It was a really glorious version of Back to Black. And she knew herself, at the end of the poem, she knew herself, she could barely stand, but she knew she just delivered this song superbly. And it was very, very, very moving. Amy's song. She is a raven, scavenging, burning stones and stars, standing somehow in gallows drop stilettos. She touches again dark red roses scattered in a hurricane of feathers, back combed and wild as moss green eyes, spilling soul and a soul's bones in a version of black I go back to time after time, catching with my long lens the darkness pouring from her mouth, like a sash of night in Camden Town, twisting, turning, rising in crosswinds, till it falls with the gone of it all, different from any before or since she was. Is about Tadeusz Pankiewicz. He was a Polish pharmacist, and he had a shop in Krakow in the area that became the ghetto, that the Nazis turned into the ghetto, where they imprisoned the Jews, the Polish Jews. They offered Tadeusz a pharmacy in another part of town that had been confiscated from a Jewish person. In fact, they offered him many choices of other shops. He refused to go. He stayed in his own shop in the ghetto and helped hundreds, perhaps thousands of Jews by dispensing medication simply to try and take the edge off the terrible anxiety that they were experiencing. He also made gallons and gallons of hair dye for the old people to see if they could fool the Nazis and be sent to a work camp rather than a death camp. So in the poem, I was trying to imagine what his first night in the ghetto would have been like after everybody else, after all the Jews had been removed and sent to the camps. Empty ghetto. The leaving began at dawn, children put to sleep with luminol, tightly packed in handheld cases, others spilling shining lumps of blue-black coal or scraps of wood emptied over balcony railings. My gifts for the leaving, bromine and valerian root, and to the old hair dye ground from indigo and henna that could not fool the cool selectors, filing faces like apparitions from some far-flung future. Alone now in the pharmacy under the eagle, I sit among coloured bottles, stoppered ceramics, pestles and mortars used to soften fear and knead the edges of pain, compounding codeine with a little hope. The wind has left the pines, only rose-grey dusk remains, seeping through skylights, cupboard doors, piano lids, floorboards, filling stairwell, basement, bedroom, attic, tenement, deep in my cold stone bowls. All the horses are long gone, the solitary sound echoing these midnight alleys, my footfall in first snow, falling on silent streets on a dead Zagody square, covering a blue star and couple of old kitchen chairs. So sort of movement from the Holocaust to what the Palestinians call Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. This poem is called No Direction Home. From Rashida camp, an air raid siren scores southern Lebanon's graffitied sky. As Fatima sits with her back to her shack's breeze-blocked walls and recalls snow-white soles of mulberry moths and the high silvery hum of leaves on each and every olive tree, suckling young and old on finest green gold, growing in Galilee's dusty grey ground, with figs and pomegranates and grapevines entwined on solid two-storey gables bought and paid for with Palestinian pounds, saved in the tin coffee box she prizes open to show a British mandate certificate of ownership for a house on Umm al-Farah and 19 Dummon of land. Taken by soldiers with scars on their eyes and arms full of ashes, O daughter, how goodly their tents, now a new moon sides, a meadow of stars. This poem is called Shergar's Room Wonders. There was a documentary on a few years ago about Shergar, and it interviewed his groom, and it was a very moving documentary. He was quite elderly and he still suffered from tremendous guilt and sorrow about what happened to Shergar. The kidnappers could never have got Shergar into the trailer, so the groom had to lead him up the ramp, and he still felt terrible about that, and also about the fact that a horse of Shergar's standing didn't get the burial that he deserved. What would Shergar's groom wonders, what friends would think if they knew history is filtered through the eye of a horse, other times would have buried in a bridle of brass with grave goods at his muzzle. Shergar's groom wonders if those rebels would have emptied a Mauser into the river running down his face, or turned him loose on mountain or meadow, slapping his rump just for the hell of seeing him run. Shergar's groom wonders if his bright boy expected car-lined afternoons, bookies shouting odds, a jockey punching air, being led up that rickety ramp the night a soul-shaped thing was glimpsed in frosted breath. Shergar's groom wonders if Equus could really be attuned to the rhythms of the human heart, his dark pulsings the last the horse heard, no other could have gotten so near. Shergar's groom wonders to this day where his bones lie, knowing they thought him the perfect hostage, free from blood, they thought wrong. The horse, more brother than his father's son, and he would have been made lovely for the earth. I'm going to finish off with two poems here, and the first of them remains at the race course. This poem's called Epsom 1913. In June 1913, Emily Wilding Davison, a very committed, very courageous feminist suffragette, was killed at the Epsom race course. She stepped out in front of the king's horse, and there's kind of a bit confusion about what she was trying to do, if it was suicide or if she was trying to stop the race. But I think what was actually more plausible is that she was trying to pin the colours of the woman's movement to the horse. As I said, she was an extremely brave woman. She had been force-fed when in prison. She had been force-fed 49 times. And hers was a very tragic end. Epsom 1913. There is no way to escape the sarcophagus of hands gripping my thighs, ankles, elbows, wrists, shoulders. I am nailed to this rank bed, and already his fingers are inside, probing the gap where he will thrust a metal screw, cranking my mouth wide open. Waiting minute by minute for that tube to fill my mouth, my throat, I cannot breathe, I am not breathing, I am drowning, and I will drown 49 times more. They do not know I was the girl with bright red hair, taking a first class honours in her Oxford finals. They do not care I was a hard working teacher, paying her way fair and square. Coming at the close of day, through grey clanking doors, they will drown me again. No stone in the midst of it all, when all else failed, flesh and blood and bone, standing on the bank of a river of horses, minute by minute waiting for the king's dark colours, minute by minute on the crashing edge, clashing in at Tattenham Corner. Too long a sacrifice, enchanting heart to globe, violet and luminous, pine green and brimming, silver starfish discharged on the breast of a three-year-old colt. An action firm and unfaltering, a scattering, viciparous and sparkling. I'm going to finish off now with a poem. It's about my grandmother, who had a child with learning disabilities herself, and he died when he was seven, and 2 years later she seemed to have what was a delayed grief reaction, and she stopped eating. And she stopped eating on the 17th of March, and she died on the 25th of May. And I've often wondered about that, what really prompted that action, that type of very private, small, individual, well not small, individual hunger strike, if you like. She was very sympathetic to republicanism, and I wondered, you know, about that tradition, but I really think she was trying to clear a space, get a room ready for her her own little ghost, her own little revenant to come back to. Fast in memory of Cassie McCotter. Stooped in an oil lamp's glow, a doctor with shirt sleeves rolled up to the elbow, manoeuvred forceps cold as anchor ice, the night you breech birth Augustine, youngest child. The bucky roses that steel kiss left on each temple pulsed as the lion paced the purple heavens. August big and blue drifted high, the Sunday you stood, chin resting on forearms, crossed on the chapel wall. Going no nearer to the grave, receiving seven summers. There was no funeral mass, no officiating priest, just a sprinkling of undertaker prayers. Today your howl would be hushed with citalopram or mirtazapine, fluoxetine or ciprolex, cognitive therapy or ECT. Those days they'd have broken your fast with funnels and feeding tubes coiled like adders on white enamel. Some still say he should have acted more decisively, taking the mountain road in a dusty black suit and bespoke broad-brim hat, quietly helping you out of the Model T Ford at the red brick asylum's door. Instead, you stayed at home, lying with your face to the wall in the dying room, clearing the ground, sweeping clean the only space your boy had ever been safe. Philip, eldest son and water carrier, keeping ebony vigils by your side, offered food on plate and saucer and spoon, silently about the time the wild geese left, for he felt his pleadings caused only distress. Evenings brought your husband to sit and speak of the day's dealings, asking if you had eaten without threat of institution or treatment jolting you to your senses. Maybe he could see, and maybe there are some wounds that cannot be healed, some sorrows better to be let be. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. The beautiful journey I led us on there. We're going to take a little break now. I said I'd do the open mic list here in my hand if anybody else would like to sign up to it. Before we go on break, we get one more big round of applause.